just a reminder that the project was due 3 minutes ago. If you haven't actually got it running on CS418, maybe you've still got it on your machine. You thought, oh, I'll get it in by the end of the day. Right after class would be a good time to scurry and go do it, since it's due. If anybody has a major issue with that, like you can't do that, I'd be willing to go till 5, or even a little later, but I definitely would like it in today. So, does anybody need more time, you know, just to get it onto the machine? Okay. Concerning midterm, I've spent a bunch of time thinking about this. As you may have inferred from my sporadic email, things have been a little crazy in the last 2 weeks. Here's what I would like to do unless someone violently objects. And if you object, I really do want to hear about it. What I want to do is a 90-minute midterm, and that means we can't do it in the class. So what I would like to do is make it a take-home midterm. And here are the ground rules. The way I would like you to proceed on the midterm, I will hand it out. It'll go out by email to the list by midnight on Tuesday. Okay. Here's how I would like you to proceed on the midterm. This is the proposal. I want you to read it. Not work on the problems. Read it over. Set it aside. Go and review what material, whatever material you think it is appropriate to review. Set that aside. And then go back and do the midterm without reference to that material. Okay? Does anybody... And just to be clear, I'm not setting this up as a way to do a killer midterm. Okay. This is my attempt to cope with the fact that I should have provided you with sample midterms and didn't. So, does anyone... And I'll make it due, let me say, at midnight on Friday. Because I don't know what your schedules are, and given that you're going to do a take-home, I don't see any reason to put any irrational time bound on it. So, does that seem reasonable? Is there anybody whose schedule is such that they couldn't do that? Okay. All right, so the ground rules are pick it up and read it, go do whatever review you need to do, put all that down, and then take it. And I hope it's unnecessary. Unfortunately, experience says it is necessary. Making reference to materials while you're taking it is cheating, right? I mean, the deal is there's a set of rules for taking an exam or a test or whatever it is, and those are the ground rules. And they're, I think, more than reasonable. And I, unfortunately, in racing out of my office, I left my calendar on my desk. But unless I've messed up and I'm in surgery tomorrow afternoon, I can't be in surgery tomorrow afternoon. So I will take review questions on Wednesday for anybody who wants them. However, if I do that, no, I will take review questions tomorrow. Before I hand out the midterm, for anybody who wants to ask them, I want to. How many people are not prepared with review questions today? But if I did it tomorrow, would come in with review questions. Don't all shout at once. Okay, in that case, let me ask your questions today, because we've already taken a spring break, and yeah, we can jump back into the file system stuff, but we've already lost context, so we might as well do it now. And that'll give you that much more time to go back and recover. So, questions? Anything we've covered this semester? This is always amusing, right? You ask something like this, half the class goes scurrying through notes, the other class sits there.
How about knowledge of the kernel tracing from the first assignment?
I'm sorry?
The knowledge of the kernel tracing from the first assignment.
What about it?
Should we really know much about that other than what we
No, the real purpose of that was to prep you for the second project, which is going to be coming out soon. It's certainly not something I would ever test on, especially since it has no right answer in principle. And maybe I should explain the reason it has no right answer. There are two. First, there are lots of places on all these paths where what happens depends on how you've configured your build. And we didn't actually specify a configuration. And I said, assume that you're not doing SMP. So that was about the only thing I gave. And there were other things that were specification dependent. I think I said assume it was 386, but I don't remember if I actually said that. In the past, I've said that. But the second issue is, if you think about what happens on that path, there are lots of places where you could sleep and the kernel could start running something else. So it's very easy to get tangled up where you miss the sleep and you end up in the other path without quite realizing what happened. So it's actually hard to get right. And when I say hard to get right, we have yet to have anyone hand that assignment in 100% correct. It became clear enough that it was bad enough that we just gave up on ever trying to grade it, because frankly that wasn't the point.
Okay. Is there ever a tool to do that?
To do what?
To do kernel tracing. Like a flag you can enable on a build or something. Is that a tool?
Well, so there are tools that do things like call graphs that tell you who calls who. The catch is that in something like a kernel, they don't tend to work very well because you have lots of procedures that don't return in the obvious way. So they get you a picture, but not necessarily a great picture. I would like to focus our attention though on questions that might be relevant to stuff we've covered, because that's the purpose today. I can go back to file systems. Seriously, are there no other questions on anything we've covered up to now?
What about history?
What about history? It's a fascinating subject, but you're a CS major. What's the question?
I'm especially early on, you talked a lot. I think you did an overview of kind of history of where we are today, or how we've gotten today technologically with computers. Other than just having a broad understanding of what questions were about?
Broad understanding is fine. If you decide that you want to work in the area seriously, it's important to know this stuff and actually really dig back into it, because an appalling amount. I had a limiting experience we've had with a paper in the last 2 weeks. Last 4 weeks. We had a paper that was shepherded. This happens when you write a paper that isn't quite strong enough for publication as it is, but it also doesn't get rejected. Often with a student paper, they'll assign somebody on the conference committee to review the paper. And one of the issues that was criticized was the feeling on the part of the reviewers the paper did not adequately cite the prior literature. Now, that's simply wrong. In fact, the paper cited all but one piece of the prior literature. The real objection was that it didn't cite it in microscopic detail at every single brain fart. My practice is I cite when things are novel, not when things are done. You know, so you do something perfectly obvious, sorry, and that doesn't get you a citation. There was a lot of that. But at one point, it became clear to us that several of the things they were pushing for was people wanted their own work cited. And they basically said, you guys need to go do a literature search. Well, so we did. What we discovered was that, for the most part, their work didn't deserve to be cited for the things that they thought they should be cited for, because there was prior art, lots of it. So when you dig into an area, you want to understand what's been done before for two reasons. One, you want to understand what's really new, if only as a matter of sort of integrity. But the other is you also want to understand what good ideas exist that you can lift. Because if people have covered an area, you can bet they've spent a lot of energy on it and learned something from it. It's a lot cheaper to learn from somebody else's experience than to duplicate it the hard way. But to answer your direct question, no history on the major. Okay. Other questions?
Is there an overview of like broad topics that would be on the syllabus?
Everything on the syllabus, other than the things that we've exempted. Yeah.
On the archives, there's the questions, the sample questions you do in the monthly. There's one that you said wasn't covered in class, so should we still be responsible for that?
Do you recall which one it was?
I
or what the topic area was?
I read it over once.
If we haven't covered the topic area in class, it's not fair game for the midterm. And somebody asked me last week, is the file system and disk system stuff fair game? The answer is no. I actually don't know if there was such a question on the list, but here's why I suspect there was. This is the first year I've run this course in 3 1-hour segments. It's a disaster, and I'll never do it again. We're 2 weeks behind where the course was last semester as of the start of spring break. And so that's why I'm pretty sure that there's some one or two things on that list that we haven't gotten to yet. But if it's not covered on the syllabus up to this point, it's not very good. Questions on actual content? Have we had any actual content? It's like when the professor sticks their nose out and says, hit me, it's fair game to hit. Yeah. All right, well, let's go back to file systems then. When last we left our picture, the file system structure that I was describing was the classic Unix file system structure. And there's an inode, and in the inode there's a size field. And there's a pointer. The whole point of this is to have a three-level tree. There's a pointer to the top of the tree. Now, let's talk about, I said the tree could be varying height. Let's talk for a minute about how you know the height of the tree. I just want to walk you through the computation, because it may not be familiar. And I also said that the content blocks are 1 kilobyte. That's great. That's completely illegible, isn't it? So, you want to know how tall the tree has to be? Here's what you do. Number one is, this is sort of a conceptual story. It turns out this step is not necessary. But I want to give you the idea, and I'll explain why this step doesn't have to be done in a second. You take the file size in bytes, you round up the size in blocks, okay? And so now what I have is, assuming the blocks were fully populated, this would be the size of the file. Now, I divide this by the block size. Now I've got the size of the file in blocks. Take it back, we do have to do this. Now, these indirect blocks form a tree. And if I were to look inside the indirect block, what I would see is a list where each entry is a block number. Now, for the next step, I have to know some details about the file system. I have to know the block size, which we've already assumed is 1K. I also have to know something about the file system size, because I need to know how big the block numbers are. So if this is a 32-bit file system, the block numbers are going to be 32 bits. If it's a 64-bit file system, the block numbers are going to be 64 bits. Let me work the example for the 32-bit file system. Okay. So if it's a 32-bit file system, then what I'm saying is, each entry is 4 bytes long. And if I know that, then how many entries fit in an indirect block? suggests our first review topic. Division by powers of two is something you really want to be able to do.
256.
256. Why?
Because it's 1K.
Because it's a 1K block size and it's 4 byte entries. What does that tell me about this tree? What kind of a tree is this tree? This is great. Not only do we get the other stuff recorded, we get the French lesson recorded too. This is wonderful. What kind of a tree is it? What's the arity of this tree? Binary tree is a tree with an arity of 2. By definition. Yeah.
So the arity is 256.
The arity is 256. The arity is for each node the maximum number of children it can have.
So would the height of the tree be the ceiling of the log base 256?
Yes. Hang on a sec though. So if I want to know the height of a tree, ignoring balanced trees, which have some artifacts that have to be considered, but if I've just got an optimally structured tree already, the rule is that I'm going to take the log of the number of items that are in the tree, and the base of that log is going to be the area of the tree. And since the tree may not be, you know, perfectly populated, this might get me a fractional result. So I have to take the ceiling of this. Now, careful. We got to be careful what we mean by height. In particular, suppose I have one item in the tree. What's this computation going to give me? 0. Okay. So we're saying then that there are 0 indirect levels. And in a tree having exactly one block, in a file system, if you had a file having exactly one block, indeed this pointer would point directly to the block. But watch for the off by one error, depending on who's doing the calculation. So in our case, we're talking about log base 256 of the size in blocks. If it were a 64-bit file system, what would that arity be? Sorry?
512.
I hope not. I hope not 512. I know you don't. That would be multiplication by powers of 2. You want division by powers of 2. How would you walk me through the computation?
So instead of
you and me both. Since I got to sleep about 4 o'clock. But walk me through the computation anyway. Because this is a good test for what state you're gonna be when you take the midterm, right?
I'm honestly 2. I'm sorry.
Okay. 64 bits. How many bytes? How many is the entry?
64. 2. So.
You really are tired.
Yeah.
How many days have you been up?
About a day and a half.
About a day and a half. Okay. You definitely need to be getting more sleep. Okay. Because if you're this far gone after a day and a half, you're in deep trouble. Because you're reacting like you're like 4 days gone. 4 days is when you start seeing funny things when you haven't seen. Okay, somebody else want to walk me through this?
It would be 8 bytes.
8 bytes. Okay, and sorry?
128.
Right, because the block size is 1K, so 1K divided by 8 is 128. So this was a 64-bit file system, I'd be doing log 128. Log base 128. And if the block sizes were 4K, what would happen then? What would the error be then? 512. You increase the block size, you increase the error. You increase the file system size, you decrease the error. Now, in the general case, logarithms are scary things, but when they're powers of two, they're straightforward. You can do them just by shifting the bits.
You don't even need a divide operation to do this.
But you divide something by 64, 64 is 2 to the 6. The implementation is you just take the number, you shift it right 6 bits. Well, you got to pay attention to the sign bit, but in this case, that's not an issue. Okay, now, I also said that there's something tricky that Unix file system did that had to do with knowing something about typical file sizes, which is that most files are small. And the problem with these indirection blocks is every one of these indirection blocks is going to turn into a C, because I can't get to any given level of the table until I process the level above them. So I'm going to cache these blocks, and that'll help. But the truth of the matter is, the vast majority of file accesses in a real system are open, read from the start to the end, closed. A very few are open, write from the start to the end, closed. And then once in a blue moon, you see a database. But that's not the normal access pattern. And the problem with that access pattern is, indeed, in order to read that first block, I'm going to have to walk the tree from top to bottom and left to right. There's just no avoiding it. I can't make up the answers. So there's a lot of incentive to reduce seek time. And one good way to do that is to reduce indirection. So the trick that's used in all of these file systems, in all these file systems, is that more pointers are added to the INET entry. Now, at this point, things get a little trickier to compute. This depends on how these pointers are used. So, suppose I were to say, so now it's as though my file consists of a bunch of trees, the number being the number of pointers that I have. So in that design, if I want to know the number of indirect blocks, indirect levels, how would I figure it out? The rule for the height of each tree doesn't change. That's a rule about mathematics and trees. The catch here is to notice that there is now more than one tree. So, what you do is divide by the number of active pointer slots. Now, how do you know how many active pointer slots there are? Well, the way to think about these active pointer slots is that they are actually another indirection block, okay? But they're an indirection block in which the entries at the end are broken. So we can't use them. Assume for a minute that you got a question? Assume for a minute that that indirection block really existed. If it really existed, then this old equation would give me the height of the tree, right? We just walk through it. So now what I need to know is whether it exists or not. The test for whether it exists is, when am I going to create it? Basically, what I'm going to do is I'm going to fill in these pointer slots as long as I've got some. when I run out, at that point I'm going to allocate a new indirection block and push all those pointers into the indirection block. So the story here is all these pointers in this story that I'm telling, this is not how EXT3 works. All these pointers point to trees that are logically of the same height. Alright, so if I want to know if that last block is there, here's what I do. I say, let me compute the height of the simple tree. One more, I just have one point. Now we get a thought experiment. That simple tree is one, it's a big tree that's made up of a lot of slightly smaller trees. Let me figure out what would be the size of the next tree down, the next smaller tree. How do I do that? Well, and I'm interested in this in blocks, by the way. You can do it in bytes, there's no need. This equation, this logarithm equation, is going to give me a height of the simple tree. Now, if I want to know the maximum number of blocks in the next tree down, I run the same equation in reverse. Right? Before I do that, for a given height, what's the maximum number of blocks that can be described by that tree? Why? Basic logarithms. Well, if that's the maximum number of blocks that could be in the actual tree, then that must be the number of blocks that could be in the next smaller tree. Because what it means to be the next smaller tree is I'm one level shorter. And this is the maximum number of blocks in the next tree down. Now, so how do I know how many entries there are in the top block? How many trees beneath it are there? Okay. So I use this computation to figure out the actual tree height, and then I use this computation to figure out how many entries there are in the top level block. Now here's the tricky part. If the number of top entries will fit in my number of indirect slots, then that top block doesn't exist. What I do instead is I encode it directly in the item. This is just a data structure trick, right? What we're doing is we're merging a truncated top block into the INET structure. We're just moving the bits around. There's no change in the logic. Is anybody not seeing how that works? You're looking puzzled. What do you think about it?
Just something with this picture is bothering me.
Which picture? There are many pictures I draw that ought to bother people.
All the way on the right.
This one here.
Yes, where you said that you're going to treat the last part of the inode that has the indirection actually built into it.
That's this part.
Right. So you're going to treat it as a as an indirection block where the bottom part of it is just invalid.
Well, the right most.
The end.
The right, end. Yeah, the end is invalid.
So it looks like you have three pointers coming out of one single area.
I'm sorry. I just didn't draw in the slot boundaries.
Okay, that's all that's wrong.
Yeah. And actually, partly because it turns out in real implementations there are like 12 or 13 of these, and I get tired of drawing the lines.
Okay.
But all that's happened here is this tail region in the inode, this region is this region. Right? We're just moving. Now, there are two boundary cases you've got to look for here. So the first is the one that I just talked about, which is how many slots are active, and that's going to tell me whether that top one actually exists. But the other one is, you know, suppose my file had one block. Then the height that I would get here would be zero. Subtracting one from this will have unanticipated consequences. Remember I said you've got to watch out for the definition of height. Okay.
Yeah.
How do you know if the block is pointing at an actual file or if it's pointing in another direction? There's some sort of descriptor.
Okay, I think the question you mean is, how do I know if a block points to a content block or an indirection block?
Yeah.
Okay. I know it because of the height. So if I have three layers of indirection blocks between me and the content, the rule is go three layers, the next one's content. I don't need any other bits to tell me which ones are which.
Does this assume a height bounds tree?
This, it turns out this tree is built sequentially, and so you actually don't ever need to balance it. It's a naturally structured tree.
Are these indirection blocks allocated randomly from the disk, or do they have a special area where they're put?
Okay, where are you taking it? So there are two parts to that question. So one, they are allocated from the general pool of available blocks in the content region of the file system. They're not allocated randomly. Different file systems have very different strategies for how to place them. And the policy decisions about how to place them have major consequences for the performance of your file system. There are some file systems that actually try to get rid of them altogether. So let me give you an example. This particular file system is terribly inefficient. It was designed for a special need. System 5 release, I want to say 3.2, but it may have been 4, had something called bootfs. bootfs didn't know how to do indirection blocks at all. It only knew how to do files that were stored strictly sequentially. So in a bootfs inode entry, you have a starting block number and a size. You go to the start, you read whatever number of blocks you need, that's it. When you add a file to bootfs, if it can't find enough storage contiguously to write that file, it compacts the file system. Now, this would be a really stupid thing to do in a production use file system. The context for which bootfs was designed was it was supposed to support the file system that only held three or four files, namely the kernel and a couple of loadable drivers. And the idea was that by eliminating the indirect blocks, you could incredibly simplify the bootstrap logic, because it didn't have to do all these computations to hunt through all these indirection blocks. So that's sort of on the extreme simple end. And in that kind of file system, you don't need any indirection blocks at all. What the indirection blocks give you is the freedom to place content more freely with fewer constraints. Yeah.
What if all your content is contiguous? Does
EXT have a shortcut? So, in principle, if you had reason to know that your content was contiguous, then you might imagine that you could optimize this data structure.
Or even like contiguous blocks, like if the file.
Let me come back to why most file systems don't do that. Turns out there's a good reason not to do that. But I haven't given you enough pieces yet.
In fact, My goal for the next 12 minutes is to try to give you an intuition for why that might be yelling.
And there are file systems that do. So I'm not 100% sure, but it would not surprise me if RiserFS does. Certainly, I know RiserFS does extent management, and extents have some of the feel of Birch Bottom. Let me just point out to you a few things that I just want to hit on the way by. I want you to see that they're possible, but I'm then not going to reference them further in class. So I said, in this design, we assume that all trees are the same height. You don't have to do that. Suppose I had a file that was exactly two of these trees plus one more block. In the story that I've told you, I'd be obligated to allocate two more interaction blocks for that last block. That's silly. It's only one legal path for those blocks. So there is an optimization. It's a storage optimization. The storage optimization says, look, notice something about these files. The rule is that a tree grows until it obtains its full possible occupancy, and then we start the next tree. So if there's an underpopulated tree, it's always over on the right. Now this means that we could take our height calculation and go a step further. We could say, what I'll do is I will recognize that if I'm in the partial, because only the tree on the right is short, notice so far, it's only possible to have one partial tree. Buy that? And by more than one partial tree, you mean that something other than something on the right was underpopulated. So what you could do is you could say, this gives me the number of top-level entries, but I know the last one could be a short tree. So I want to know the height of the last tree. If I conclude that I'm looking at the last entry, then check. If I conclude that I'm looking at the last entry, what I'll do to figure out the height of the last tree, I will subtract out the sizes of the preceding trees, and then whatever size is left, that's the size that's relevant for determining the height of the last tree. And you can go even one step further. So this would mean if I had one block, I don't need any indirection blocks. I'm going to recognize the last tree as partial. If I had two blocks, I only need a lower direction block, because that's enough. Now, if you're really sleazy, you can go even further than that. You can say, I can actually have a bunch of short trees over on the right. And this is a little tricky. So remember that when we started, we said we were going to fill up the number of indirect entries. And then when we ran out, then we were going to allocate an indirection block. So the trick now is we're going to do that again. So suppose we had four entries. First time we run out, we allocate an indirection block, but now we have three entries free. We could use those three entries for three more blocks and not grow another tree until we ran out of those three entries. So you start looking at a fairly hairy algorithm, but after you've looked at these algorithms enough, it's actually not so bad to figure out what's going on. And the rationale here is actually not the same. These indirections are incredibly expensive. They take like 10 milliseconds each. That's
a lot of time. That's forever. Hard to imagine 10 milliseconds being forever. There it is. The other thing I want to say is, if I am looking for a particular block, how do I know what path to take through the trigger? I've got an entry, how do I know which slot I'm looking for? Well, I reuse this equation. Okay, so if I have a tree with a height of h10, and I'm looking for the slot in that topmost block, I take this equation, which is going to tell me the number of top entries. I replace, instead of using the total number of blocks in the file, I use the block I need. So if I'm looking for block 3, what I'm trying to determine at the top level is, if to traverse this level, what I need to know is which of these trees is block 3 in. And a somewhat odd way to look at that is say, well, if I needed to store 3 blocks, how many of those trees would I need? The answer is 1. And here again, remember the 0-1 issue with logarithm. Since I only need 1, I only need this tree in the front. And this tree in the front is named by the 0th slot. So if I take, if I run this equation, it's going to get me exactly what I need. Now, I'm not going to do division to do this, because remember, the heights are integers, and the bases are powers of 2. And that means this divisor is a power of 2, and that means this is a shift operation. These equations are actually very fast when you actually go look at the implementation. It's actually an interesting exercise to write a tree walking algorithm like this, compile it with optimization turned on, and then go look at the assembly code. You'll be amazed how little it looks like what you put in.
I'm talking about how computational efficiency this is, but isn't the vast majority of delay actually seek time?
Yes, it's true that the efficiency of the computation is absolutely irrelevant compared to the time it takes to seek. And many people use that as an excuse to write crappy file systems. Crap is a technical term in this context. Okay?
And it's still in all caps and it applies to most Linux file systems. However, those cycles are not being spent doing useful work someplace else. The fact that disk is going to be slow is not a reason to take cycles away from some other process that can get something useful.
Most of the way is for seek times, if you reduce the seek time significantly by turning it all into one sequential read, you can, same way you can implement a binary tree in an array, but if you implement a 256 array tree in an array?
You could, except that now what you're going to do is you're going to commit yourself to a story that says that I'm always going to allocate 256 sequential blocks, because I have to know that, because otherwise when the file grows, I'm going to have to move it around. So, there are file systems that do what you're talking about. There's an idea that's called an extent. And the idea is, well, there might be two layers of organization. One is the block level, where I'm just looking for a block. But at a certain size, I'm going to say, hey, you know, it'd be good if I could linearize some of these blocks. So what I'm going to do is now I'm going to grab something called an extent. An extent is simply some sequential number of blocks, usually the power of 2. Maybe 64 blocks. I'm making up a number. Might be a megabyte, if on the database. Might be 128 megabytes from the database. DB2, I think, actually does use 128 megabyte extents. So, the idea is, above a certain size, I'm going to say, look, it's time to actually, it's now big enough that it's worth thinking about linearizing these blocks. Now, instead of looking for a block on the disk, I'm going to look for a contiguous chunk that could be a whole extent. I'll allocate that and I'll move the blocks into it. And the reason I'm doing that is for linearization. So yes, it would help. And tomorrow I'm going to talk about a file system that carries that idea to extremes in a very interesting way. You're anticipating the next topic, actually. But before we go away,
I want to hit you with one issue here, which is why one might not want to do the optimization that you mentioned earlier. Imagine that I have a file. It's an in file. I open it, I write some stuff, my machine crashes. Now, it's kind of a funny case because the thing is, the machine could have crashed an instant earlier or an instant later. This file is not in a consistent state. I have no way of knowing how many of its bytes made it out to the disk. So it's reasonable to say that the unit of loss in a file system when something goes wrong might be the entire file. I'm a little unhappy with that. That model works fine as long as files are written in one go. It's not so happy when files get modified. Because now what we're saying, and that's the notion, and that is the notion of Unix file systems, is if I get caught with my pants down at the wrong moment modifying etc password, and the system crashes in the wrong way, just in the wrong instant, hey, I could lose etc password, all of it. And the reason that's an issue is the file system doesn't have a model of transactions. It's not part of any of the classic file systems. There are newer file systems that do. There's a further problem, which is, you know, this assumes that operations on files are independent, but you may have noticed that in Unix there's a thing called etc shadow. And when you add someone to the system or you change their password, you actually have to touch both etc shadow and etc password. And you have to touch them in a synchronized way. Either both changes go through or neither one goes through. Actually, that was the original plan. They discovered that that wouldn't work real well if your system crashed at the wrong moment. And there is now an ordering that's actually sort of well-defined what happens. Now think about what happens when I'm modifying a file or when I'm extending a file. What am I going to do? One, I got to allocate a new content block. To do that, two, I got to update the allocation bitmap or whatever data structure I'm using in the file system. Three, I have to modify an indirection block because I've got to write a new entry. Four, I've got to modify the inode structure because the inode structure keeps bookkeeping information like what was the time of last modification. That means I have to rewrite the block containing the inode structure. So there's four blocks I've got to write. Any of these writes can be the one where some jerk pulls the plug. And just to be really helpful, those good people at Maxdoor and Western Digital and Hitachi have added things called caches to drives. You don't even know when those writes actually make it to the disk. You have to take special steps now to make that data actually go to the disk. So here's the problem. Consider what would happen if I were to do these writes in some order, pick an order. I've got four writes I've got to do here to add this block. So pick an order and ask yourself the following thought questions. For each of these blocks, whatever order I do them in, if I fail after this one, you know, pick one, right, one of these four. If I fail after that one, how bad is it? What have I lost? Now, after you're done with that one, ask yourself, if I manage to have the incredible bad luck to fail in the middle of writing the block, not between two blocks, I get half of a block written to the disk. Now what have I lost? What's the scope of the damage? For example, if I'm updating that inode entry and I only write half of the block containing the inode, guess what? It's not just this inode that I've just pooped on. I've just lost a chunk of the file system and I don't know what else was in there. So what are the consequences? What can I do about it? And how could I think about recovery? So those are the topics for tomorrow. All right.